addiction story wants a villain. But America has never been able to decide whether addicts are victims or criminals, whether addiction is an illness or a crime. So we relieve the pressure of cognitive dissonance with various divisions of psychic labor. Some addicts get pitied, others get blamed, that keep overlapping and evolving to suit our purposes. Alcoholics are tortured geniuses. Drug addicts are deviant zombies. Male drunks are thrilling. Female drunks are bad moms. White addicts get their suffering witnessed. Addicts of color get punished. Celebrity addicts get posh rehab with equine therapy. Poor addicts get hard time. Someone carrying crack gets 5 years in prison, while someone driving drunk gets a night in jail, even though drunk driving kills more people every year than cocaine. In her seminal account of mass incarceration, The New Jim Crow, legal scholar Michelle Alexander points out that many of these biases tell a much larger story about who is viewed as disposable, someone to be purged from the body politic, and who is not. They aren't incidental discrepancies between black and white addicts, drinkers and drug users, but casualties of our need to vilify some people under the guise of protecting others. What do we hold against the drug addict? Asks theorist Avital Ronell, and answers with a quote from Jacques Derrida, that he cuts himself off from the world, in exile from reality, far from objective reality and the real life of the city and the community, that he escapes into a world of simulacrum and fiction. We cannot abide the fact that his is a pleasure taken in an experience without truth. This vision of the addict, as an agent of betrayal, undermining the shared social project, has been an enduring character in what criminologist Drew Humphreys calls the drug scare narrative. It's a classic American genre that singles out a particular substance as cause for alarm, often arbitrarily, without an increase in use, to scapegoat a marginal community. It happened with Chinese immigrants and opium in 19th century California, with black cocaine use in the early 20th century South, with Mexicans and marijuana in the 1930s, with black heroin use in the 1950s, with the inner city crack epidemic of the 1980s, with the rise of meth in poor white communities at the turn of the 21st century. Meth was called the most malignant, addictive drug known to mankind. Barns across America showed graffiti as prophecy scrawled across their peeling paint. Meth is death. Posters and commercials showed ghouls who were strung out, rake-thin, yellow-fanged, picking at their facial sores and neglecting their babies. But by the time a 2005 Newsweek cover story called meth America's new drug crisis, meth use had been declining for years. Calling the drug scare narrative a toxic genre isn't a denial of the damage drugs can cause or the devastation addiction leaves in its wake. Only an acknowledgement of the ways that addiction has always been two things at once. A set of disrupted neurotransmitters and a series of stories we've told about disruption. Addiction becomes a contagious epidemic, a willful abnegation of civic duty, a valiant rebellion against the social order, or the noble outcry of a tortured soul. It depends on who is doing the telling and the using. Columbia University neuroscientist Carl Hart writes about the drug story that hasn't gotten much airtime, the not particularly exciting non-addiction story that never gets told, which, as Hart reminds us, is the experience of most drug users. Yet addiction has been presented as both inevitable and unilaterally devastating in order to serve various social agendas, most notably the war on drugs. The 20th century American crusade against drugs was effectively launched by a man named Harry Anslinger, who took over the Federal Bureau of Narcotics in 1930, just as Prohibition was starting to fall apart. Anslinger effectively channeled the punitive impulse that had fueled Prohibition, the impulse to see addiction in terms of weakness, selfishness, failure, and danger, and redirected it toward narcotics. It wasn't just a metaphoric connection or a psychic sublimation. Anslinger's Bureau of Narcotics physically took over the same grim offices that the Prohibition Agency itself had occupied. But during the decades that followed, the American legal system would polarize alcohol and drug addictions into separate categories in the public imagination, the former a disease, the latter a crime. It can be tempting to equate hard drugs with addiction or booze with recreational use, but in truth, the distinction between them is mainly grounded in social norms and legal practice, and it hasn't always been this way. Before the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act of 1914, which regulated and taxed the distribution of opiates and cocaine, you could easily order drug works from the Sears Roebuck catalog, a syringe and cocaine package deal for $1.50, or buy Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup made with morphine from your local pharmacy. By the 1950s, however, Anslinger was describing the majority of heroin addicts as psychopaths who were created by infectious contact with persons already drug-conditioned. What do we hold against the drug addict? Anslinger's language of contagion synthesized competing notions of disease and vice, imagining the addict as a morally culpable patient zero. It resurrected rhetoric he'd used when he'd worked in the Bahamas during Prohibition, urging the Navy to round up bootleggers and smugglers by claiming they carried loathsome and contagious diseases that would infect the people who drank their booze. Anslinger understood himself as a moral crusader, but dressed like a mafia tough guy, the same guys his policies kept in business, wearing shiny suits and ties printed with Chinese pagodas. He struggled in the early years of his crusade to keep his agency afloat, and after his funding was nearly cut in half in the mid-30s, he was hospitalized for a nervous breakdown in 1935. This was the same year he oversaw the introduction of a radical new step in American drug legislation, the Narcotic Farm, a federal facility for addicts that opened outside Lexington, Kentucky in May of that year. Part prison, part hospital, jointly administered by the Bureau of Prisons and the Public Health Service, the narco farm was the institutional embodiment of America's ambivalent relationship to addiction. It was also a working dairy farm, the source of its nickname, although more than one administrator worried that it would be mistaken for a facility that actually grew opium. At any given time, roughly two-thirds of the 1,500 patients at Lexington were prisoners who had been convicted of violating federal drug laws, and the other third were volunteers seeking treatment. Though often these volunteers had been in trouble with the law themselves and were seeking an alternative to legal punishment. If addiction was both vice and disease, then residents at the narco farm were both prisoners and patients, vols and cons. They were being simultaneously punished and rehabilitated. By the time the narco farm opened in 1935, America didn't know what story to believe about addiction, whether to punish it or heal it. And everything about the narco farm reflected this confusion. The names it was called, the press coverage it got, how it was run, even how it was built. It had towering walls and barred windows like a prison, but it was also full of day rooms with huge windows overlooking the rolling green hills of Kentucky, and its vaulted ceilings and soaring arches suggested something more religious, like a monastery. The architecture of possible salvation. Harry Anslinger wasn't just a policymaker. He was a storyteller. But most of his addiction stories didn't get to the part about redemption. They were just stories about deviance, meant to inspire fear and to justify punishment. In his case for Making War on the Narcotic Addict, Anslinger was fond of quoting a Los Angeles police officer, "I feel that these people are in the same category as lepers, and that the only defense society has against them is segregation and isolation whenever possible." After Anslinger's budget was slashed, his fear-mongering became more urgent. He spent the rest of the 30s creating a reason for his agency to matter by drumming up public anxiety about drugs, and he ruthlessly exploited racial fears in his campaigns. Arguing that marijuana unleashed black male lust for white women, he gave the House Committee on Appropriations a speech about colored students partying with white co-eds and getting their sympathy with stories of racial persecution. Result? Pregnancy. Racial paranoia has been part of American drug scare narratives as long as they've been told, even though the majority of drug users have always been white. Even before Anslinger, this paranoia fueled public support for the Harrison Act. "Negro cocaine fiends, new Southern menace," ran a New York Times headline in 1914. And similar articles spread the myth of the black fiend as an almost supernatural enemy. In 1914, a Literary Digest article claimed that most of the attacks upon white women of the South are the direct result of a cocaine-crazed Negro brain. In 1953, Anslinger published a book called The Traffic in Narcotics, a manifesto defending the drug war he'd spent the last two decades waging. It was also meant to pave the way for legislation he supported. The Narcotic Control Act of 1956 mandated minimum sentences for distribution, 5 years for a first offense, 10 years for a second one, and expanded the provisions of the Boggs Act of 1951, which allowed the death penalty for selling heroin. Later that decade, James Baldwin published Sonny's Blues, a short story that dramatizes the fact that every addiction lives at the intersection between public and private experience. It's a story about trying to understand addiction from the outside, and it focuses on the relationship between two brothers, both black men raised in Harlem, a schoolteacher trying to parse his jazz musician brother's inscrutable dependence. In Baldwin's account, addiction is both social and interior. Though heroin is part of the reality of being black, in Harlem, in the middle of the 20th century, it's also part of a deeply individual inner conflict. Sonny struggles with the junk that brings him bliss, that feels like a woman singing in his veins, but also traps him alone at the bottom of something that is often unbearable. Anslinger's Traffic in Narcotics, published just 4 years earlier, advertised itself as the first book to treat with authority the horrifying national problem of drug addiction. But its posture was precisely the opposite of Baldwin's. Instead of respecting the contradictions and depth of any addict's consciousness, it created cartoon villains who would be easy to justify locking away. The book's flap copy insisted that it had been written not to satisfy a desire for morbid sensationalism, but as a basic description of the current situation. Its mission was simply to guide and implement the national desire to strike at the roots of a disturbing menace, a source of crime and wrecker of young lives. No sensationalism here, only the wreckage of young lives. Anslinger was just going to tell you about the marijuana fiend who raped a 9-year-old and the one who killed a widow, the one who brutally attacked 16 women to steal the money to buy wine and reefers which he consumed at the same time. You can almost hear the hysteria. At the same time. Anslinger was not going to satisfy a desire for morbid sensationalism, but he did want you to know that when judges dished out discretionary vacations instead of doling out real hard time, bad things happened. Case in point. The marijuana dealer who was fined only $25 for possession of 17,000 grains of marijuana, and the next year raped a 10-year-old girl while under marijuana intoxication. Anslinger described his book as a long-awaited reliable survey, suggesting that he was refusing to pander to the rising tide of drug panic. But the syntax was a sleight of hand. He'd spent much of the last two decades stoking the flames of this panic in order to generate support for his floundering federal agency. The most toxic agendas often disguise themselves as pure transcription. In his manifesto, Anslinger insists he doesn't like to generalize. He just observes that addicts want to be shielded from the world, while normal people feel no need to rise above their usual emotional plane. Addicts are invariably greedy for more and more pleasure. Anslinger's accusations summon Derrida's argument that we resent the addict for taking pleasure in an experience without truth. 6 years after the traffic in narcotics, William Burroughs would write that the face of evil is always the face of total need. But Anslinger was busy reconfiguring the face of total need as evil. His concept of illness was selective and self-serving. He called addicts infectious, but dismissed anyone who called them sick. Blue's Child Baby, an autobiographical novel about a heroin addict named George Kane by an author and heroin addict named George Kane, was published in 1970, nearly two decades after Anslinger's manifesto, but still bears the residue of Anslinger's punitive campaigns. The novel turns on a powerful scene of shaming. When George goes to see a doctor for help in kicking his habit and gets treated like a criminal, that asks the same question, are addicts sick? It's not incidental that George is a black man. He's also fresh from prison, where he was serving time for possession. But by the end of the novel, he's deep in the throes of withdrawal. Even his vomit shows signs of struggle. Live things, frogs and insects kick in the liquid coming out. When George's girlfriend, Mandy, suggests that he see a doctor, George knows better. He tells her, a doctor won't help. And sure enough, as soon as George tells the doctor he's a drug addict, the doctor immediately proves him right. He backs up from his desk and draws a pistol. The scene doesn't unfold as a conflict between men so much as a conflict between narratives of addiction that don't agree. George and Nandy insist on addiction as a disease. He's a sick man. You're a doctor, says Nandy. And George insists, I'm sick, in pain like anybody else that comes to you. But the doctor and his gun won't surrender the narrative of addiction as vice. Get out of my office before I call the police. I am precisely the kind of nice, upper-middle-class white girl whose relationship to substances has been treated as benign or pitiable, a cause for concern or a shrug rather than punishment. No one has ever called me a leper or a psychopath. No doctor has ever pointed a gun at me. No cop has ever shot me at an intersection while I was reaching for my wallet, for that matter, or even pulled me over for drunk driving, something I've done more times than I could count. My skin is the right color to permit my intoxication. When it comes to addiction, the abstraction of privilege is ultimately a question of what type of story gets told about your body. Do you need to be shielded from harm or prevented from causing it? My body has been understood as something to be protected rather than something to be protected from. In her memoir, Negroland, Margot Jefferson describes the ways black women in America have been denied the privilege of freely yielding to depression, of flaunting neurosis as a mark of social and psychic complexity. That is a luxury available to white women. It's been glorified in the literature of white female suffering. It took me years to understand that my interior had never been interior, that my relationship to my own pain, a relationship that felt essentially private, was not private at all. It owed its existence to narratives that made it very possible for a white girl to hurt. Stories that suggested her pain was interesting, that it was proof of vulnerability rather than guilt, worthy of sympathy rather than punishment. When I started to drink, to really drink, to become conscious of my drinking, not just in terms of pleasure, but escape, I was ashamed, but also proud. My urgent attempts to disappear from myself suggested there was something dark and important, depression, neurosis, psychic complexity, that required disappearing from. It wasn't that I slipped on pain as a garment. It was more that I tried to understand the pain as psychic compost, something with an aesthetic purpose. I wanted it to complicate and deepen me. I did most of my unpunished drunk driving in California during the winter after I graduated from the writer's workshop. When I lived with my grandmother, Dell, my father's mother, in her sunstruck home at the top of a hill, the house my family and I had lived in for much of my childhood, I was trying to write a novel. She was dying. During those months, I stayed in a bare room without much furniture to speak of. I lived for the relief of drinking alone on my futon mattress, after night shifts as an innkeeper at a bed and breakfast by the ocean, a 10-minute drive away, and often drank at work, in secret, then drove home tipsy, always anxious, to drink more, back in my room, where I didn't have to worry about anything. Each day, I woke as early as I could and smoked on a little wooden balcony. The days were perfect blue skies and sun, eerily identical, and every day I grimed the salt air with puffs of smoke, left tiny gray piles of crumbled ash on the slats of wind-scoured wood. My fingers yellowed. I made Dell oatmeal and sat with her while she ate it, resenting this time because I wanted to be writing, and feeling guilty about my resentment because I wanted to be someone who didn't feel it. Dell had been a constant presence through my childhood, had lived with my family for years. A generous, resourceful, steely-nerved, and intensely loyal woman who loved us fiercely, me and my brothers, who'd raised two manic depressive daughters and survived her marriage to an alcoholic husband, who'd left the Daughters of the American Revolution because she didn't agree with their politics. My favorite memories of Dell, though, were of little things. Our weekly bridge lessons, with every trick carefully observed by the porcelain mice on her bookshelves. She always warned against the dangers of bidding too high, but bid aggressively in practice. We played for nickels and dimes in the pot. I loved Dell, respected her stoicism and her selflessness, and remembered all the ways she'd cared for me. Wanted to return that care, but felt overwhelmed by what she needed, and hated to see her need so much. My brother and sister-in-law were also living with Dell, and I kept my empty bottles away from our communal recycling in a separate plastic bag in my closet so they wouldn't see how many I'd accumulated. Dell was falling more frequently, sometimes falling asleep on the couch beside a cooling patch of spilled coffee. She was mixing up her pills, and I didn't even know what pills she was on. I was terrified for her and for myself. How was I supposed to take care of her? There was a photo of us I loved in her bedroom, her holding me in her arms when I was a baby. She looked so happy, so utterly capable. In those winter months, she almost never complained about pain or her decreasing mobility. By contrast, with little to complain about, I was animated by self-pity like toxic electricity. We eventually installed something called a Lifeline Medical Alert System, a direct phone line Dell could activate if she fell, using a button that hung around her neck. Sometimes I would come home to find she had fallen in her bathroom or that she was bleeding on the carpet with spilled chicken soup hardening beside her. One morning, I found the machine beeping in the corner, a voice on the other end of the line asking, "Are you okay?" And then I tried to talk to it. "I'm here," I said, and the voice asked, "Are you the caregiver?" And I honestly didn't know what to say. I was, and I wasn't. I was trying to help Dell change out of her bathrobe because it was soaked in coffee, and I was crying, and Dell was asking me why I was crying, and I was trying to pretend I wasn't crying, and I was picturing that photograph, me as a baby in her arms, and now the voice was asking, "Is this the caregiving situation?" It was like some distant, useless god was living in that machine and judging us. Is this the caregiving situation? My brother and sister-in-law and I were doing what we could. It clearly wasn't enough. My father and my aunt, both passionately devoted to their mother, were calling every day, but they both lived on the other side of the country. Intellectually, I knew it wasn't my job to keep her from dying, but it still felt like what I was supposed to do. Sometimes, my sister-in-law and I went to the grocery store and loaded our shopping cart with sweet things. Boxed coffee cake, mint chocolate chip ice cream, pink champagne, and binged on it all, just for the relief and escape of total indulgence, putting things into our bodies to remind ourselves we weren't anywhere near dying. My life with food was a boom-bust cycle, composed of succumbing to fits of indulgence and then compensating by eating very little for days. It was still easier to eat when I was drunk. One night when I was sick, we rented Legends of the Fall, and I took a shot of liquid Benadryl and passed out after 3 paper cups of cheap pink champagne, curled into the couch. Staying awake meant unimaginable exhaustion. I fell asleep with Brad Pitt's long hair swinging like a curtain between one state of consciousness and the next. In those days, I tutored students who went to the same high school I'd attended. Their parents were impressed by my credentials and slightly dismayed by the life these credentials had secured for me, full of days spent tutoring their children. After tutoring, I drove to the bed and breakfast and showed guests to their rooms, suites with tasseled curtains and floral patterns and jacuzzis. When they made their reservations over the phone, married women often said, "We need a king bed," and you knew they meant it. I also imagined being all the guests that I checked in, with longing or schadenfreude, as I carried their luggage and wormed my way into the inner lives I had constructed for them, cheating on their spouses or else, miraculously, still loving them, with a full or partial ocean view as backdrop to their love. Every evening, I put out wine and cheese for the guests, and after it got quiet enough, I put out wine and cheese for myself. I never thought of this as drinking on the job, although strictly speaking, or really any way of speaking, it was. I drank carefully, usually, enough to get a good buzz, but not so much that I'd show it or mess up the nightly credit card batch. Not so much that I'd lose my specially cultivated innkeeper serenity when guests came into the kitchen to make small talk. I imagined myself blurting out, "At home, my grandma fell down again," saying, "Pull up a chair." I ate little cheese cubes on crackers to soak up the excess booze inside me, or dug a spoon into the bowl of cookie dough in the fridge and ate it like yogurt. I usually left with an extra bottle or two from the pantry, tucked into my purse, walking out gingerly so they wouldn't clank together. Sometimes I tucked a sweater between them. The great secret of evening wine and cheese was that the guests could drink half a bottle of Chardonnay or 3, who would know? I had a margin. Driving home every night in my red Dodge Neon, $1,000 buy with a ragged stick shift, I was especially anxious about the stop sign on the steep hill just behind the inn. I always revved the engine when I pulled off the clutch, perpetually scared that my revving would draw the cops from secret perches in the darkness. Even on the flat stretches, I drove slowly. No doubt suspiciously so, jerking and wrenching as I toggled between gears. Once I got home, I would go up to my little bedroom and drink one of the bottles I'd stolen from work. I didn't care that the wine wasn't chilled. When you're drinking cheap Chardonnay called Two-Buck Chuck and drinking it alone on a futon mattress, Googling people from high school and scanning the real estate firms they work for, it turns out temperature isn't the point. On that futon mattress, drinking tepid wine, it was impossible to deny that getting drunk was the point, just like it had always been the point. During those California days, I still nursed a certain romantic notion of myself as a lonely writer, drinking heavily but waking every morning to write my novel. Not but, actually, something more like and, something more like because. My nights of lonely drinking were part of the same psychic descent that was producing the grim novel I was starting to imagine, about a lonely young woman taking care of her dying grandmother. It didn't have a plot beyond that. This wasn't exactly the romance of the White Logic, Jack London's myth of the drunk prophet and his truth serum of booze. I was living with my grandmother and my brother and my sister-in-law, barely supporting myself with 2 jobs, ducking like a coward out of my meager responsibilities, passing out on pink champagne and cold medicine, a long-haired Brad Pitt haunting my strange dreams. This life wasn't backyard parties with bratwurst on the grill and lights in the trees. It wasn't drinking with other drunk writers at bar tables carved up with the initials of more famous drunk writers. This was just a futon and a bottle of room temperature Chardonnay. Sometimes I poured the wine and sometimes I didn't. The glass had started to seem like little more than a contrivance. In 1944, a novel came along that rejected the white logic entirely. Charles Jackson's The Lost Weekend refused the idea of drinking as metaphysical portal. In the novel, alcoholism isn't particularly meaningful. It just is. The plot moves roughly like this. A guy named Don Burnham gets drunk. He's gotten drunk before, and he'll get drunk again. He drinks, passes out, wakes up. He keeps drinking till he runs out of money, then he finds some more money and picks up where he left off. At one point, he tries to pawn his typewriter for cash and walks almost 100 blocks before realizing all the pawn shops are closed for Yom Kippur. Another time, he steals a woman's purse to see if he can get away with it. He doesn't. That's pretty much the whole story. Drinking, and then more of it. As critic John Crowley has observed, the novel was revolutionary in its unrelenting simplicity and redundancy, its rejection of an abiding mythos. Don Burnham wasn't a new type of protagonist because he was a drunk. He was a new type of protagonist because his drunkenness marked him as a man with a disease rather than an existential albatross around his neck. Don isn't broken by the fallen world or the horrors of war or the cruelties of love, like Ernest Hemingway's drunken specimens of masculinity or William Faulkner's wasted Southern patriarchs or F. Scott Fitzgerald's prodigal patrician husbands. Don is just dependent on a particular physical substance. His drinking is pathetic and repetitive. It doesn't deliver him into the subtle clutches of metaphysical angst. It simply means he makes a fool of himself all over Midtown Manhattan. Published when Jackson was 41 years old, 8 years after he got sober for the first time in 1936, The Lost Weekend was an immediate bestseller. It ended up selling almost 1 million copies over the course of Jackson's lifetime. The New York Times called it the most compelling gift to the literature of addiction since De Quincey, and argued that it could be a textbook for such organizations as Alcoholics Anonymous, an organization that, at that point, Jackson despised. When he was drafting the novel in 1942, Jackson wrote to a psychiatrist at New York's Bellevue Hospital, Dr. Stephen Sherman, to request permission to visit his alcoholic ward for research purposes. Jackson had been there himself as a patient, but, not surprisingly, couldn't remember much. He also sent Dr. Sherman his first few chapters, looking for feedback, or probably just affirmation. Dr. Sherman thought the novel should have definite clinical value, and said it had taught him more about what the alcoholic is really thinking than most of his patients, especially in its evocation of loneliness and an identification with forlorn genius. In the novel, Don has big plans to write the story of his life. If he were able to write fast enough, he thinks, and, presumably, keep his typewriter out of pawn, then he could set it down in all its final perfection. But the titles Don imagines for his book suggest his insecurities. Don Burnham, A Hero Without a Novel, or I Don't Know Why I'm Telling You All This. He wonders why anyone would be interested in the story of his life. Who would ever want to read a novel about a punk and a drunk? The joke is clearly on us, his readers, who are doing exactly what Don can't imagine anyone wanting to do. Reading a novel about a punk and a drunk, a would-be writer who can't summon enough sobriety to tell the story of his own intoxication. Don helpfully catalogs all the aesthetic failures of his own story. It has no climax or closure. It holds no emotional suspense. He already knows how he will feel after the first drink and after the 10th, how he will feel after he wakes up hungover the next morning, because he has already felt all these ways before. During a particularly embarrassing, climactic moment near the end of the book, Don finds himself facing off against a maid, trying to get her to unlock the liquor cabinet, and is overwhelmed by a distinctly literary moment of self-loathing. Melodrama. In all his life, he had never been in any situation so corny, so ham. He felt like an idiot. His taste was offended, his sense of the fitness of things, his deepest intelligence. I don't know why I'm telling you all this. Jackson was ashamed of his own story as he wrote it, and he outsourced that shame to his protagonist. Don is ashamed not simply of his actions, but of his genre. The fact that his own drinking doesn't amount to anything compelling. It wasn't even decently dramatic or sad or tragic or a shame or comic or ironic or anything else. It was nothing. One afternoon when I was 9 and my father was 49, I asked him about drinking. Why did people drink? Why did some people do it so much? We were standing in my parents' bedroom. The huge glass windows were hot with sunlight, the sky blue and shameless beyond. I can still remember where my father was standing as he closed the rolling cedar door of his closet, wheels squeaking in their tracks. And I can remember his creased khaki slacks, the cloud of intensity and distraction he moved through like a private weather system. I remember these details as if they were seared into me, saying, pay attention, saying, listen up, listen to what? A single moment, that day, my father told me drinking wasn't wrong, but it was dangerous. It wasn't dangerous for everyone, but it was dangerous for us. It was thrilling to share any type of us with my father, who was a magical figure to me. There was always some part of him that was elsewhere. Every few weeks, my family had calendar sessions, nights of curt tones, explanations, bargaining. When my father drew his work trips as color-coded blue and purple lines across the grid of days on a dry erase whiteboard calendar. Sometimes he joked that he wanted a color to mark the trips he hadn't taken. He had grown up moving constantly as an Air Force brat to Japan, California, Maryland, son of an alcoholic pilot. As an adult, my father was part of all the frequent flyer clubs named after precious stones and metals. He was the mileage king. He was an economist working on health policy in the developing world, and his work took him to Thailand, Switzerland, Rwanda, India, Kenya, Burma, Mexico, distant places where he met with other influential people, always men, I imagined, to figure out how to spend money most efficiently to alleviate global disease burden, a phrase I learned young. The things he was interested in talking about always seemed to involve things I didn't know. What did I know about? Hopi Kachinas and Mark Twain's real name. Whenever my father praised my intelligence, it was like a breadcrumb in the forest. If I could just keep doing that, he'd keep paying attention. I listened hard to show him that I was a good student, absorbing everything he was telling me. He told me about the Concorde, which went faster than the speed of sound, how your pee went backward if you went to the bathroom while it was decelerating. He had seen places I couldn't imagine. He once told me about an acid trip he'd taken that was the first time he'd ever believed it might be okay to die. He loved amaretto cookies and good burgundy. He played tennis in striped sweatbands. His laugh was everything. He brought me miniature shampoos from all the hotels. An apology paid against the ledger tally of his absence, all those lines on the whiteboard calendar. Years later, I would learn about his affairs. He was often cheating, even on his mistresses, driven not by malice, never that, only a certain restlessness. When I was young, 6 or 7, my dad gave me a stuffed tiger named Winifred. He chose her name, which was much better than if I'd named her myself. It was like he'd embedded a piece of himself right in her plush stripes. When he went away on trips, Winifred stayed. When he returned, he told me stories about the adventures she'd had, wherever he'd been. If he'd been to Bangkok, she'd had adventures in the jungle. If he'd been to China, she'd had adventures in the Gobi Desert. I don't remember how I squared the logic of these tales, how Winifred's body stayed behind, while another version of her lived a gossamer life beyond my reach. But I imagine it was comforting to consider the possibilities of a split self, how a person's heart or mind might stay at home while the body traveled elsewhere. My father loved to tell a story about seeing me as a newborn in the hospital hallway, and I loved to hear him tell it, how he looked into my eyes under my pink beanie and seen something piercing in my gaze, a curiosity he'd loved from the start. It signified some primal bond that lay between us. The few times I stayed alone with him, when my mother went out of town for work, all we ate was ramen and popcorn and milkshakes. It was divine. It was our secret, another bond sealed, like when he said drinking was dangerous for us, including me in the same danger. When I was 9, he moved across the country for 18 months for work, and when he moved back to Los Angeles, my parents separated officially. This was the same window of years when my brothers, 9 and 10 years older, moved to college. In only a few years, we went from a family of 5 to a family of 2, just my mom and me. The men were gone. After my second brother left for college, I drew a picture of myself crying in his bedroom because I missed him so much. I even gave it a title, Jealous Sorrow. Certain truths had turned transparent as glass because they were so ingrained. People would probably leave. It was just a question of when. Attention was something I had to earn, not something I could take for granted. I had to seduce at all moments. My brothers were witty and kind, but also a tough crowd, smart and reserved, not willing to give up their laughter or praise for just anything. My oldest brother, Julian, taught me how to solve an equation for X when I was 7. "Great," he said, "but can you solve when X is on both sides?" I loved my brothers wildly, extravagantly. Loving them was like flinging myself against something, as I often flung myself at their tall bodies to hug them, demanding their love with the sheer force of my hurtling 40-pound body. I was always loved, but I always wondered, also, what that love depended on. It did not seem unconditional. I wondered what I had to do to keep deserving it. I can't remember a time when I wasn't trying to figure out what to say at the dinner table, especially on French nights, when everyone was practicing a language I didn't speak. After my parents divorced, when I was 11, my father got an apartment overlooking a grove of eucalyptus trees. Maybe once a year I spent the night, scouring the fridge for things to pack in my school lunches. A half-drunk bottle of mineral water, leftover sushi with a torn packet of soy sauce jammed underneath. In those days, I didn't know how to talk to my dad, so I stared blank-faced at a TV while he asked me why I was getting a B- in world cultures on my midterm progress report. I craved his approval like I craved perfect grades, perfect test scores, or I craved these things like I craved his approval. Getting good grades was the natural extension of being a little girl trying to figure out the next right thing to say at the dinner table. I was alternately stone-faced and sarcastic in those days of early adolescence. Shy at school, convinced I smelled bad, that I loomed like a giraffe, and quiet with my father. I couldn't ask for what I wanted then because I didn't know I wanted it. Loving him was always like reaching for something luminous. Reaching was what love felt like. My father's love was always there, in a tiger, in milkshakes, in his gaze, in his laugh. But I was most sharply aware of his care when my own body was in danger. When he visited me during the year of my eating disorder in college, he left me with hundreds of pages of photocopied academic journal articles about anorexia. He fixed me in the full glare of his concern. I remember a particular moment between us as strangely sublime. It was just before my jaw surgery, after freshman year of college, when I was headed into 6 hours in the OR, lying under a heated hospital blanket, giddy from the pre-anesthesia laughing gas, Valium making me feel tucked in like a soft quilt. My dad watched as they wheeled me away on the gurney, his eyes glistening with tears. And I wanted to tell him, from the comfort of my laughing gas, my Valium perch, that everything would be okay. If drinking was dangerous for us, I came to learn that drinking had been particularly dangerous for one of us, my Aunt Phyllis. Phyllis was my father's middle sister, a woman I had never met. The history of her estrangement from our family had been explained to me vaguely, a blurry story. But as I grew older, her distance from the family was always described in terms of drinking and mental illness, like twin knobs bringing the microscope slide into focus. Phyllis had started fights. She'd slap my grandmother. She'd once chased someone with a knife. As a girl, I was obsessed with Phyllis, with the fact of her distance and the mystery of its cause, with questions about what she had been like before and what she was like now. My father wasn't even sure where she lived. I begged for the most recent address we had and sent her hopeful letters, "Hi, I'm your niece," that never got a reply. As I grew older, I began to identify with Phyllis, or with the ghostly shape of her absence, for no logical reason I could name, except that she'd clearly been someone who had trouble living in the world as she was supposed to live in it. I always lived in the world as I was supposed to live in it, but I sensed there was an animal in me, beneath all that obedient living, some part of me that wanted to do what she had done, start fights, make scenes, fall apart. When I was young, I turned Phyllis into a romantic hero, blaming her estrangement on my family, imagining her all alone somewhere out there, in exile. But as I got older, I realized it had been more complicated, that you can commit yourself to a troubled person over and over again, and it might never be enough. Back in my childhood home, watching my grandmother die, I kept imagining Phyllis. Where was she? Did she miss her mother, wherever she was? How could she not? My drinking didn't look like her drinking had, but I wondered if there were blueprints inside both of us that weren't so different. When I went outside to smoke each morning, I passed the closet door where I could still picture my father standing, saying, "Drinking isn't dangerous for everyone, but it's dangerous for us." Addiction has always been more dangerous for some people than for others. When Nixon launched the original war on drugs in June 1971, he called drugs public enemy number one, but it was actual human beings who were imprisoned. Blue's Child Baby, George Kane's novel published just a year earlier, had effectively predicted Nixon's war before it officially began. They say you're arrested for crime, narcotics, prostitution, robbery, murder, George thinks in the novel. But these are not the reasons for locking you away. In an interview decades later, Nixon's domestic policy chief, John Ehrlichman, confessed precisely this. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. He said the Nixon administration couldn't make it illegal to be black, but they could link the black community to heroin. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Kane understood the ravages of heroin as well as anyone, and his novel summons that devastation without mercy or reserve. A pusher shoving ice up a woman's vagina to bring her back from an overdose, or a haunted huddle of junkies nodding, stinking, burning, high, lit by the glow of a TV playing cartoons. When George visits the projects where he was born, he gets a junkie named Fix to cop for him, a guy so sick he's desperate for a cut. Gaunt and hollow, skin strapped tight around the skull, there's not enough junk in the world to quench his need. But Kane also understood that criminalizing addicts only compounded the damages that addiction itself had wrought, and Blue's Child Baby is a difficult, prickly book in part because it's trying to tell two stories that sit together uneasily. The damage of drugs and the ways this damage is deployed as moralizing rhetoric. The war on drugs was officially launched twice. Nixon announced his war in 1971, but it wasn't until Ronald Reagan's call to arms, a decade later, in 1982, that the war truly took off. Drug use was actually declining in 1982, and only 2% of Americans thought drugs constituted the most important issue facing the nation. But by launching its war, the Reagan administration effectively created an enemy, another version of the figure Anslinger had called the addict violator. As sociologists Craig Reinerman and Harry Levine put it, it was easier to place the ideological fig leaf of a crack epidemic over the devastating impact of trickle-down economics than face this impact directly. Reagan's war on drugs picked up where Anslinger's crusade against addicts left off, placing a new set of addict archetypes, crack mothers, tweakers, base heads, inside familiar narrative dioramas about moral deviance, reality avoidance, and epidemic irresponsibility. A 1986 feature in Time magazine called The House is on Fire, one of the first major media accounts of crack, presented its addicts as villains in a doomed morality play. The argument began, police say, when Beverly Black accused her boyfriend of spending their last $15 on crack. She stormed out of their one-room apartment in Freeport, Long Island, late one night last week to try to borrow some food stamps. Darren Jenkins, 23, an unemployed cabinet maker, stalked over to the bed where Black's son Batik was sleeping. High on crack, an extremely potent and addictive form of cocaine, Jenkins allegedly beat the little boy to death. Batik would have been 3 years old this month. It was a horrible act, unthinkable, but it was also carefully deployed to incite public outrage at addict villains whose lineage reached back to Anslinger's child-raping, widow-killing marijuana fiends. The article didn't present any addict suffering, just an addict killing a baby. Darren was unemployed, too busy copping drugs to make any cabinets, and his girlfriend wasn't letting her habit get in the way of her determination to abuse the welfare state. Like a piece of exotic travel writing, the article ushered middle-class readers into an illicit underworld, summoned by suggestive ellipses. Crack it up, crack it up, the drug dealers murmur from the leafy parks. The crack scare managed to combine the narratives of addiction as disease and vice by imagining crack as a predatory epidemic spread by Black addicts who were morally responsible for what they carried. These scare tactics invited the narrative thrill and ethical imperatives of combat. As a director of the DEA's New York office noted, crack was the hottest combat reporting story to come along since the end of the Vietnam War. And by the mid-90s, the metaphor of war had turned into something more concrete. Police departments got millions of dollars in military equipment from the Pentagon. Bazookas, grenade launchers, helicopters, night vision goggles. They got military training and SWAT teams. They were allowed to confiscate the cash, cars, and homes of everyone arrested in drug busts. But many of the people waging that war hated it. One politician would call government anti-drug policies the legislative equivalent to crack. They would offer a short-term high, he argued, but would be catastrophic in the long run. One San Francisco judge wept on the bench after imposing a 10-year sentence on a shipyard worker who'd carried drugs to help a friend. The public stories told about addiction had consequences. Between 1980 and 2014, the number of incarcerated drug offenders increased from just over 40,000 to almost 490,000, and the majority of those incarcerated were people of color. A 1993 study found that only 19% of drug dealers were African American, but they made up 64% of arrests. Michelle Alexander put it like this: by waging a war on drug users and dealers, Reagan made good on his promise to crack down on the racially defined others, the undeserving. When Nancy Reagan launched her famous Just Say No campaign in 1982, its slogan didn't offer advice so much as implicit recrimination. Just Say No meant also some said yes. As George H.W. Bush's national drug control strategy would put it a decade later, the drug problem reflects bad decisions by individuals with free wills. In its insistence that addicts not be seen as victims, U.S. drug policy continued to echo Anslinger's frustration with the altruists who called addicts sick. When Reagan signed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act of 1986, he implemented mandatory sentencing for first-time drug convictions and put in place the infamous 100-to-1 ratio, which mandated vastly disproportionate sentencing for those caught with crack rather than powder cocaine, a policy that converted the racial scare tactics of the war on drugs into actual prison terms. One 1995 survey asked participants, "Would you close your eyes for a second, envision a drug user, and describe that person to me?" Even though African Americans constituted only 15% of the nation's drug users, 95% of the respondents pictured someone black. This hypothetical drug user was the product of decades of effective storytelling. The story I got to live was a different one. Throwing up during blackouts, bruises on my shins from stumbling upstairs, coke dusted under my nose like powdered sugar from a slice of coffee cake. These legible residues of fairly unremarkable dysfunction. Some parts of my drinking life have become comfortable grooves in memory. Whiskey shots, reckless nights. But those months with my dying grandmother aren't comfortable to remember. It's the resentment I regret most. The ways I wished myself away instead of being where I was. The ways I resented showing up to make her oatmeal each morning. One night, after coming home from my night shift at the inn, I drank my bottle of room-temperature wine and watched a movie on my laptop about a man who had squatted in an abandoned bus in the Alaska woods, then gotten stuck there when the creeks swelled during spring thaws. By 1 in the morning, I was imagining myself into his bus, wishing myself alone, though that was hardly the moral of the story. During those days in California, I discovered that I actually preferred drinking alone. It was easier without anyone watching how much I was drinking or expecting me to produce anything, wit, good cheer, or explanation. "I enjoy it much more because I don't go to bars," Berryman once said. "I just order it in and settle down with it." One night, my sister-in-law and I came home to find my grandmother lying naked on the tiles just inside the front door. She told us she'd fallen on her way to the bathroom, but she wasn't anywhere near the bathroom. She was talking about my grandfather, from whom she'd been divorced for decades. I couldn't remember the last time I'd heard her say his name. My sister-in-law called 911, and I went into the bathroom to try to gauge which of her pills she'd been taking, because the Lifeline calls had taught me they'd probably ask. But all her pills were spilled across her counter and in her sink. When the EMT guy arrived, he asked me who took care of her on a regular basis. "You're 23, and this is a lot for you," he said, "but she deserves more." After Dell was admitted to the hospital, once she was sleeping in her room, my sister-in-law and I went to an IHOP across from the hospital and got chocolate chip pancakes. I emptied an airplane nip of rum into my coffee in silent conspiracy with my sister-in-law. This was the time it was okay to drink, understandable. But I longed for another kind of drinking, a bottle of wine alone, in selfish privacy. Dell had a heart attack a few days later. She died in a bed in the ICU, her body cluttered with tubes until they took away the life support and there was just the morphine and her swollen face and fingers, puffy with pooling fluid. Near the end, she had spoken not about her own physical discomfort, but mainly about my father and my aunt, the two children who remained in her life, and how fiercely proud she was of them. She had been a good mother for almost 70 years, and that duration, that constancy, was staggering to me. All those packed lunches and worried nights. I tried to imagine the pain she must have died with, knowing she'd tried as hard as she could with her middle daughter, but had somehow lost her anyway. After the memorial, my family found an address for Phyllis in Montana and sent her a letter saying that her mother had died. We got a letter back from Phyllis, who said she was living alone in a cabin at the end of a dirt road. She thought it might be a good place for the whole family to gather during end times. There was something in that gesture, the idea that she still wanted to provide for us, the ones she hadn't seen in years or hadn't ever met, that moved me, even as it suggested the ways she was still ill. The novel I was working on began to change its shape. Phyllis was creeping into it, or the idea of Phyllis, anyway. In the novel, the young woman who is taking care of her grandmother begins searching for an aunt she has never met, a woman named Tilly who has been estranged.